If it's whoever it is, they need looking after. So we've got a duty of care, and reality is it's a game.
Coaches, welcome to the Talking Split podcast yet again. I am Rob Calder from Basketball Victoria, the coach education manager there. Joined today by Daniel Hamilton from the Bendigo and Ballarat Concussion Clinics. You can follow along with their pages on socials at Bendigo Concussion Clinic and at Ballarat Concussion Clinic on Instagram if you want more information. But we are talking about an area of the sport that we probably don't want to be dealing with all that often, but we are finding ourselves dealing with more and more in head knocks and concussions in that sort of space. So we dive into what is a concussion, how to best treat them, some of the warning signs, some how you would even identify it in the first place. So Daniel does a great job of just giving us some resources and some background in that sort of space that can help parents, coaches, and players be a little bit more aware of what goes into a concussion, because, I mean, the data is pretty scary that it wouldn't be unusual to go through a season and have, you know, one or two head knocks, and you're never really too sure, like, what's a concussion, what's just a sore head, where does it sort of sit in between? So Daniel does a great job of breaking all that down. So we'll jump into the pod with Daniel now. So coaches, thanks for jumping in again. Joined today by Daniel Hamilton, who is the Director, Physiotherapist and Exercise Physiologist at the Ballarat Concussion Clinic. You would have think I've had a head knock the way I've butchered that on the intro straight off the bat. Daniel, thanks very much for jumping in today. Can you just give us a little bit of background on your end and how the clinic started in the first place?
Yeah, no worries. Thanks for having me, Rob. Yeah, good question. So I grew up in Rochester, just outside of Echuca there, and grew up there, played footy, went to school, done all that stuff. Came to Bendigo to study uni. Done exercise physiology for a start, then physio, and worked privately for a few years. When I was working privately, worked at a really good clinic that we were able to see quite a few sports injuries, sports people in general, and then also worked with a few different clubs. So the Bendigo Spirit in basketball, Bendigo Braves in basketball, been WNBL and NBL One levels, and then a lot of junior athletes, and then also got the opportunity to work at the Bendigo Pioneers Football Club in the Coates Talent League. So while we were putting all this together and doing all these different jobs, we were seeing that concussion was happening at every level, whether it was national level in the WNBL, NBL One, Bendigo Pioneers, and then grassroots footy, netball, basketball, every other sport as well. So we're seeing them happen. We could get a diagnosis from, you know, doctors around, but after the diagnosis, there wasn't much around in order for actual rehabilitation and assessing that the player was actually ready to return to, whether it was school, work, sport, whatever they wanted to return to. So yeah, instead of complaining about that there's nothing around, we thought we'll dive in and start something. So for starters, we started the Bendigo Concussion Clinic about 12 months ago, a little bit over 12 months ago. So that was in the pipeline for a little bit, and that's going really, really well. And then I actually live in a place called Quingibora now, so just outside of Daylesford. So I'm sort of halfway between Bendigo, Ballarat. So we thought, well, while the going's good, keep Bendigo going and then start the Ballarat clinic as well. And we've had a really good response in Ballarat. And when I say response, people booking in and trusting us with their rehab after a concussion. So that's sort of how it all got started.
Yeah, it'd probably be one of those spaces where you'd almost wish you don't exist in a lot of ways as well. Like, it's into that real intricate space, I suppose, where concussion's been so much more prevalent over the last 10 years or so. Like, people are more aware of it now, but it's almost a bit of a throwaway term at times as well without really understanding what it is. And I certainly remember myself as a younger coach, and we're going back maybe 15 or so years now. I absolutely coached a player that got a massive head knock in a game, was 100% concussed. But I didn't realize it at the time. I just thought they were a little bit woozy. By the time they got themselves together again, they'd be fine. And it was almost that mentality of, oh, look, you'll be right. You know, just grab yourself a breath, you know, settle your car and calm down, and then you'll be all right. And only now we're sort of seeing more and more about concussion, and we actually understand a little bit more about it. And in particular, not just the short-term repercussions, but the long-term effects of it as well. So I'm kind of curious, what is concussion and how do you sort of define it, and what are the symptoms behind a concussion?
Yeah, good question. So, in terms of what a concussion is, so it's a mild traumatic brain injury. We've got to be clear that it's not a head knock because concussion can happen from a head knock, yes, but it can also happen from a hip and shoulder and that whiplash type injury as well. So, mild traumatic brain injury when there's a force that's transmitted to the brain and creates a shearing force in the brain. Going back one step, the head knock, I've had a head knock because some head knocks can also not be concussions, or not all head knocks are concussions, not all concussions are head knocks. So that's an important distinguishing factor as well. So there's a few definitions that get thrown around. Yeah, that's the one I sort of use most common. Whether that's right or wrong, I'll leave that to the experts and people that write them up in different textbooks. But in terms of symptoms, really good question. In my head, I try and break symptoms down into three categories. You've got your red flags. Now, red flags aren't necessarily a concussion symptom, but they're the red flags that we obviously need to go to the hospital ED. That's a medical emergency. They need to be checked for brain bleed, skull fracture, spinal cord injuries, neck fracture, that side of things. So after a potential concussion, we have the red flag category, and that's stuff like neck pain, pins and needles in the arms, double vision, loss of consciousness, those type of symptoms. The next section is I call them clear signs of concussion. This is stuff such as tonic posturing. So when the hands curl, again, just blank stare, memory impairment, these type of things that even a person that's untrained in the medical world would be able to tell that they've had a very a potential concussion mechanism. They're showing these clear signs. We need to definitely remove them from the activity that's caused the concussion. The third one is the one that you're probably asking about is they talk about 22 signs of concussion. Now, these are stuff that are hard to detect sometimes. This can be as I'm not going to say as small as, but as nitty-gritty as emotional change, slight behavior change, even mild headaches in there, all these types of symptoms. So there's 22 of them. There's a lot of them. But again, any symptom, even by itself, could potentially be a concussion if it's related to an incident that's a potential concussion incident. In terms of common ones, so I'll delve into it a little bit more. In terms of common ones, the headache's definitely a big one. Headache, dizziness, neck pain, just not feeling right, and just general fatigue. So whole system fatigue, I find, Rob, is a big one as well. Lethargic, that type of thing. Don't want to go to school, don't want to get up in the morning, sleep disturbance. There's a lot of them, but yeah, they're very, very common ones.
Yep. So, I mean, you described probably 90% of teenagers, I suppose, as you're going through that as well. Like, a bit lethargic at times, a little bit groggy at times. That can, how do you, I suppose, do you distinguish between the two of just, hey, this is kind of business as usual for this, potential player in whatever sport it might be, and actually, this is something a little bit more serious that we have to take, further steps on?
Yep, good question. What I always go to is the mechanism. So if there's a mechanism and they have a symptom that they didn't have prior, so say we're playing basketball, and yes, the player might be a teenager, they're a bit irritable, they're not sleeping and they're a bit moody, all that side of things, and they're a bit moody going into the game. That's fine. They get a potential concussion. So let's say they have head versus floor, and we bring them off and we go, okay, what's going on? Tell me. And they go, oh, I've now bump my head on the floor, I now have a headache and some neck pain, or I've got a bit of blurred vision, whatever that might be. You look for a symptom that wasn't there just prior, the best you can, but you're also distinguishing it with a mechanism. The mechanism is the main thing. We need a mechanism for a concussion. So if they're, moody beforehand and moody afterwards, well, that's okay. That's where it does get hard. But in saying that, we will look for something that wasn't there just prior to the incident as well.
Yeah, right. That makes a lot of sense because it is one of those things where I suppose the change of behavior is such a massive part of it. And we know what kids are like. They go at a million miles an hour until they can't go at a million miles an hour and those sorts of things as well. And a lot of times they don't want to give up information on that sort of thing as well. Like the ultra competitive kids are their own worst enemy because no, I feel fine. I feel fine. And that's certainly what I fell victim to when I was the coach and the player assured me they were feeling fine. And it was only when they were handed Panadol and they dropped it and started reaching for it about a foot to the left of where the actual Panadol was. It's like, okay, this is not where it needs to be. Like, it's scary when they
Yeah, for
first go through
sure.
it.
Yeah, definitely. And that adrenaline surge that we all get playing sport or whatever activity we're doing, yeah, it's a big thing because, most of us that play sport are competitive and you want to stay out there. You don't want to come off for an injury that you can't see. Your leg's not snapped in half. So, why aren't I back out there? The thing that we do need to be stern on, especially as coaches, as healthcare professionals, is that there's research now to say that players that are concussed early in a game, so say, let's say we sustained a concussion first quarter and we continue to play, that is high risk for a longer recovery afterwards. So even just staying in the game for a longer period of time, I won't quote exactly how long. I think it's they. I can't think off the top of my head. Apologies, Rob, but there's evidence to say that your recovery or your symptom will stay prolonged after the game if you stay out there for the remainder of the game rather than coming off immediately.
Yep, no, makes a lot of sense. I reckon I saw, and again, it was on social media, so maybe take this with a grain of salt, or correct me if I'm very wrong on this one. But I reckon I saw something along the lines of after a concussion, your risk of doing an ACL goes up. And it's not necessarily for the next half hour, it's for about the next week or so. Like, is that the link?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, so there's good research to say that soft tissue musculoskeletal injury, so ACLs, hamstrings, calves, are at a higher risk. There's some research, I'm pretty sure it says up to 90 days now
Wow.
after a concussion that you're at a higher risk. There is a term for it. Dr. Alan Pierce has used it before. Again, sorry, I'm sounding like a blank page at the moment, but there's a term for it with the brain signal getting to the muscle minutely altered because of the concussion, therefore leading to potential muscle tear, ligament tear, that type of thing. So again, we've got to rehab them properly, make sure they're right to go back, and then if they're clear, then we hopefully minimize that risk of soft tissue. But if we just go do your 21 days and then come back willy-nilly, then that's where it potentially still is a risk.
Yeah, and it is. I think coaches get put in a really challenging position with this as well, because I think they see a player go down with a potential head knock or concerns about what's going on. They're not qualified to diagnose it. I would suggest 99% of cases, they might have a paramedic background or something like that where they can deal with trauma on the spot and those sorts of things. But most coaches won't be able to diagnose it on the spot. Is that a fair assessment on what we're probably dealing
Yeah,
with?
spot on. So, even myself as a physio and exercise physiologist, I will always get a doctor involved first. So that actually the player or student person needs a referral into the clinic from a doctor first, and that's not for a Medicare purpose. That is because we want the player or person to see a doctor, get cleared of red flags. No, we don't need any imaging, then they're referred into us. If we have red flags or need imaging, they go and do all that first and then come into the clinic. So going back to your question, sorry, Rob. Yeah, the coaches, so identify possible concussion or potential concussion, bring them off, hold them off. That's your job and duty of care. Great, we've done that. Now what they need to do is go and see a doctor, whether that's at urgent care centers or something that's popping up all around the state now and are very, very valuable. If you've got a red flag, like I said, ED, but urgent care can be seen on the day. So urgent care is just a step down from the ED. You need to be seen that day, but you're not dying, so you can go there as well. Or team doctor, GP as well, as soon as you can. Again, you don't need to present to ED with all concussions. If you have a red flag, then you need to go to the ED, and that all that information is available everywhere online, what a red flag is, through the AIS, Basketball Australia, all those side of things. So yes, in terms of diagnosis, onus is sort of on doctors there not to handball it across to them, but that's where, the medical world is.
Yeah, definitely. And speaking of handballing, I suppose, for lack of a better term, like, as a coach, it's not your job to decide whether they should play or not. If you have a concern that you, even a sneaking suspicion that something might not be quite right, that player sits out. Like, it's a non-negotiable in that world.
Correct. And I think, the analogy I use, like if I asked you, Rob, when you were 16, who did you play in round nine in your season over summer? Like round 9, 10, 11, you can't tell me. And reality is, like, you might have had 50 points, and that's fine. That's great for you at the time. But reality is,
Fair
you don't
chance it
remember
wasn't
that
that,
now.
mate.
But like, you get what I mean? So we've got to be also realistic that even if it's, you know, your Dyson Daniels, you know, he's probably wrapped in cotton wool more than others coming through the juniors. But if it's whoever it is, they need looking after. So we've got a duty of care. And reality is it's a game, whether it's basketball at an NBA level or whether it's basketball at the grassroots level, reality is it's a game and we play it. So we've got to make sure that our health is okay for after basketball or school and job and, you know, income and all that side of things as well. Because that's a big one that not a lot of people talk about is the loss of income that comes with a concussion and a concussion that's mismanaged.
Yeah, and it's a real dangerous space, obviously, because we are seeing really the long-term repercussions of this. And we are seeing sports such as cricket now have, you know, concussion replacements. AFL have gone down that path as well. So it's actually nice to see, because I think it gives coaches and volunteer coaches, frankly, a little bit of a leg to stand on and say, look, I'm not convinced in this sort of space that we should be putting them out there. And I think that's a really confronting space for a lot of coaches, because they have to tell a kid who wants to play, no, you can't play. You potentially have to break the news to the parent who, depending on the parent's background and those sorts of things as well, they might also be saying, look, we really want them to play. We think they're okay. But for mine, I want to be able to sleep at night and know that I haven't put a player in more harm by just putting them on a court for what is ultimately a game when they've got potentially the whole rest of their life ahead of them.
Correct. And that's where the clinics have been really good. And we've got good feedback from sporting clubs. I was at a school today. We're getting good feedback from clubs, schools, workplaces that we're making it an external problem for them. So talking from a staff level, say at a basketball club, coach, because the clinic exists, they can send their player to the doctor. They're referred into us. Great. We take care of basically their whole rehab, their return to play, all that side of things. So when they go back to you guys, you don't actually have to tell them, look, you can't play, or you've got to do this at training. Like, that's our job. So we sort of remove that, because coaching is difficult, as you know more than anyone. Coaching to build that relationship and rapport with someone, it's very difficult to then say, look, like, you can't play when the player wants to play. So we sort of take the onus of that as part of the clinic and sort of have those tough discussions, because reality is that's our job. And yeah, you guys have enough on your plate with coaching and kids and all that without having to, you know, rehab them and know all this at the same time.
Yeah, and the rehab one is where I'm keen to get into next more than anything else, because it's one thing to be identified with a concussion and be diagnosed and those sorts of things. But I think everyone's got a different idea on what a rehab looks like. I mean, you mentioned 21 days before. Is that the general sort of rule of thumb after a concussion or not?
So, yeah, so we'll go into it. So 21-day minimum is what basically the AIS, so the governing body, has put out in Australia, and that's made from the World Board of Concussion. So they get their information from them, and that's held every 4 years, and they rejig what the evidence says. At the moment in Australia, like I said, so AIS, minimum 21 days. Now, it's minimum 21 days because we know basically what happens during a concussion. We get a drop in brain energy for the following 7 to 10 days after a concussion. So if I'm on the screen there, so concussion happens here at 100% brain energy. We get a slow drop over 7 to 10 days, roughly to 80%, depending on the person. We stay there for a couple of days and then we slowly improve back to 100%. Somewhere between, the evidence actually is interesting, somewhere between 21 to 35-ish days, depending on what you read. So everyone's a little bit different there. So that's why it's a minimum 21 days. So it's the bare minimum to get that brain energy back, but the player might not, or the person might not be ready at 21 days. And again, that's what the clinic's for. Now, in terms of anecdotal evidence, in terms of clinic evidence, it's not a paper or anything, but we've only had a handful of people that have actually cleared all their tests in the 21 days. Most people with acute concussions haven't actually ticked all the boxes by the 21-day mark. So that's an interesting one for you as well. And that's just just what we're finding here, or what I'm finding here. So sorry Rob, we can circle back around to your question, but yes, so 21 days is where it's minimum, sorry, is where it's at in Australia at the moment.
Yeah, that's interesting in itself, because I think most people sort of have the impression of, oh look, you know, about a week and then I'm good to go again, and the reality is obviously a long way from that in that space. And look, understanding everyone will be slightly different. You know, if this is your first concussion, it's probably different to someone that's had four concussions who probably needs a lot longer in that sort of space. And it's amazing how often we go to schools and we're presenting on exactly this, like concussion and child safety in particular, and how to not have your players injured. And we ask the kids in the room who's had a concussion before, and invariably in a classroom of about 30 odd kids, 4 to 5 kids will put their hand up within that space, and not necessarily just basketballs, but from other sports as well. They maybe had a cricket ball that's hit them in the helmet, or you know, they've been on the bottom of a packet footy and you know someone stomped on them, or whatever the case might be. But it's amazing how willing they are to go, yeah, I knew I had a concussion and it messed me up for a long period of time. Like, not many of them are saying I was good after a week.
Correct. Yes. The interesting thing, Rob, around 70 to 80% of people with a concussion will get rid of their symptoms by about day 14. So I think this is why we were having trouble. So the AFL, again, not to talk from an AFL point of view because I'm not on any boards or anything like that, but I think that might have been why it was originally a 12 and 14 day protocol, because most people were getting rid of their symptoms at around 14 days, 70 to 80%. We now know that symptom resolution doesn't mean that the brain's actually recovered fully. So we've still got that last week or that third week from day 14 to 21 of actual potential recovery, even though we don't have symptoms. So it's not like your sprained ankle where we go, okay, you know, bruising's gone, swelling's gone down, I actually feel pretty good. Knee over toe test that everyone does. That's all good. Beautiful. We've got no pain when we're hopping, changing direction. Let's get back into it. That's great for ankles and hamstrings and calves, but we know that the brain's a little bit different. So different tissue, different recovery. So yeah, that even though we've got no symptoms, we still have to be cautious that we tick all the boxes. And that's why we put people through certain tests with rehab that we'll no doubt go in and talk about now what we actually do in concussion rehab.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you hit the nail on the head. Like, if someone gets a rolled ankle, they're probably just going to tape it up tighter and just make sure that they can play. And look, you'll probably be able to get through it. It'll be more swollen afterwards than it was going into it. But ultimately, you're not really going to do, you know, significant amount of long-term damage in that. Obviously, you can. But when you compare that to the brain, that's where I think the danger sort of hits in the impact that can have. And I remember there was a different athlete or coach that got a head knock on a Sunday afternoon in a senior game. We're fine afterwards, like, you know, normal afterwards, fatigue, all those sorts of things. That's not unusual. But it wasn't until about 3 or 4 days later where they were driving into the sun at the time, and that hit, and just straight away, like, had to pull over. That was the repercussion. Oddly enough, it wasn't necessarily at the time, but again, went to a doctor, got diagnosed, and like, yeah, you got a head knock a few days before, your brain hadn't recovered, and that's triggered it after the fact. And that's alarming, to be honest.
Yeah, it is. It is. And that's why we need to also organize follow-up as well from a medical side of things. So say, you know, we send our player to urgent care ED and they actually go in and they go, look, like, I actually have no symptoms. And they might be completely telling the truth, and that's fine. But that player then needs to be followed up, exactly what you said, whether it's 3 to 7 days after the fact. Because as I said, I think the reason that we get the delayed concussion, there'll be a very, very scientific way to no doubt answer this, but my thinking and what makes sense to me is that energy drop in the brain over the first 7 to 10 days, that could be a reason why all of a sudden it's actually triggered at day 4, day 5, day 3, whatever it is. That makes sense to me as why delayed concussion could potentially come on then, because of that brain energy drop. So I think follow up from our side of things, but also it will become normative over, you know, the next 10, 15 years, because we're doing the groundwork in it at the moment as yourself as a coach and me as a clinician. But it's important that we follow people up more than just once.
Yeah, and you've nailed it there, because I think we have that little bit of a feeling of, hey, how are you feeling? Good, good. And that's kind of it. And that's almost where the triage finishes in a lot of cases, is that if you tell me you're feeling good, I'm just going to assume that you're good and we're fine without actually doing any rehab on the concussion. And that's, it's not like an ankle where you can just, you know, ice it, you know, elevated foot. We've all gone through the ricer or the pricer or whatever you want to go with it. But, you know, we've all heard that sort of stuff before. How is a head knock different in terms of rehabbing that?
Yeah, good question. So we know, like I said, so with that graph, you know, if you pitch it in your head, you drop it for the 7 days, couple of days staying at that 80% roughly brain energy, and then we recover between 21 to 28 days-ish, depending on research. So that's the brain's recovery. Now, we also know that because during a concussion, other systems can be affected. Now, those other systems can be your neck, so your cervical spine, your visual system, so eyes, your vestibular system, okay, so inner ear. You've also got your autonomic system, so that's heart rate, blood pressure, your nervous system, so fight or flight system, rest and digest system, they can all be affected. There's also the side of the psychological side after a concussion, so anxiety, depression can both flare as well. There's also research to say that the gut actually can change as well. So again, I'm not qualified to discuss how concussion can change gut microbiome, but they know in like chronic inflammation in the body from a concussion, your gut can definitely change and feed into that. So our diet post-concussion is actually quite important as well. But a little bit outside of my scope. So if we steer back, sorry, neck, eyes, inner ear, and then autonomic system, which is in high play during exercise. So if you want me to break them down, Rob,
Oh, hit
and
me.
talk
Yeah,
about it a bit.
definitely.
Yep. So in terms of what we look for, we obviously go through some cognitive stuff too, sorry. So we use different app-based devices and a few things to measure reaction time, memory, some balance stuff. So phones are that sensitive these days. We can actually get people to hold their phone and it'll measure how much they move on their balance tests and things. So instead of just me recording, oh, they put their foot down twice, we can actually measure it quantitatively as well, which is really, really
Awesome.
good. So there's a lot of stuff in the cognitive world. So memory, reaction time, like I said, months of the year backwards, dual tasking. So balancing, counting backwards by sevens from 100. That side of things. So that's the cognitive side that we test and then retest over time. If it's improving, great, we're getting better. If it starts to then plateau, then if we don't have a baseline, then we go, oh, look, like that could potentially be a normal. We run that idea until we're proven otherwise with all the other tests and then put it all together. Then in terms of the neck, sorry, Rob, so I'll jump around a little bit from each one.
No stress.
So that's the cognitive side. Then if we go to the neck or cervical spine, we know that we can't have a concussion without a whiplash. Concussion happens at about 70 plus G's of force, between I think it's 70, 120. Sorry, and then whiplash can happen somewhere between 6 to 6 plus. G's of force, so significant difference. So whiplash happens in the neck. Neck can be a big referrer into headaches, dizziness, all sorts of things. I've had patients come in where I can push on their neck and reproduce nausea, dizziness, tastes in their mouth. Don't ask me how the taste one works, but all sorts of different things, reproduce migraine symptoms, a lot of different things. So the neck's a big one.
Yeah,
Big
right.
one for prolonged symptoms because it often gets overlooked. Not by other clinicians, but just overlooked in general because it's a head injury that we're talking about or a brain injury. So we're not thinking about the neck. So that's a big one. Eyes and the visual system. So we do certain tests like tracking and circadian rhythm. So different targets. So looking at one thing, then switching between. And then also looking at a target with our eyes, but then also moving our head, whether we're walking, sitting, turning head, that side of things. So the ability to move, but also keep track of a target with our eyes. And then there's some peripheral vision tests and things like that. So there's quite a bit in vision also. And then in terms of the inner ear, so the vestibular system, we've basically got a 5 cent piece sized, I call it a pretzel. Basically, the pretzel's hollow, granules of crystals or sand, as I call it, basically move around in that little canal, and that tells us whether we're hanging upside down, whether we are heads to the left, right, gives us feedback. Okay. Now, during a concussion, during trauma, granules of sand can move out of a certain canal into another one or just be really slow and sensitive. So we do certain tests to see whether the inner ear is actually causing dizziness and other symptoms as well. So it's another side of it. And then we've got our autonomic system, which is basically exercise. So in terms of exercise, we know that when returning from a concussion, increasing the blood flow to the brain, i.e. exercise, higher blood pressure, can bring on symptoms. So it's important that we actually manage that and rehab people properly via certain exercise and a few different tests to make sure that we're not pushing them back to training early, getting a higher heart rate of training and then incidentally having symptoms. So that's our job in the clinic to make sure that we're sending people back to training at the appropriate time. So that's a bit of an overview. It obviously goes into quite a bit of intertwining depth and a few different things as well, Rob. But if you had to break it down into categories, that's a lot of what we focus on. It gets a bit nitty-gritty when you get into each one of, okay, well, the whiplash is a problem. How do we actually treat that? That's a different story, which might be for another day. But yeah, that's the general thing of how we treat. We it sounds silly, but we don't technically really treat the brain. To be honest, it's all other systems that are sort of playing up because of the concussion.
Yeah, Daniel, if you've done nothing else, you've proven to me that I know nothing about this stuff in comparison to what I probably should know more than anything else. It's because I look at a lot of players that have had concussions, and you sort of ask them, "Well, what did you do for that first week?" And they usually come back, "I just slept, or I just sat on the couch." And I'm really conscious that when kids sit on the couch, or even adults that sit on the couch, in all honesty, they tend to doom scroll a little bit. And how bad is that for rehabbing a concussion? Is screen time?
Yeah, good question. It's an interesting one. So the first 48 to 72 hours, I'll say 24 to 72 hours because everyone's a little bit different, but we should be relatively resting then. So minimize your screen time in there the best you can, only using the phone if you really need to. Otherwise, do a phone call so you don't have to look at the screen. So if we use an analogy, you've got a torn hamstring, sprained ankle. Okay, so we're not going to go sprint on either of them in the first 3 days, right? So let's actually give our brain a bit of a rest and go, you know what? Let's actually leave the screens, leave stimulation that we don't need, because especially social media for kids and games on the phone is so much stimulus. That's another story, but so that's a big one. So in the first 24 to 72 hours, I would be saying, yeah, really try and limit it the best you can. Now, you might not have that many symptoms, but again, give your brain a chance to recover to make sure that you've got the best prognosis going forward there. So screen time past 72 hours is an interesting one. If it starts to push into your symptoms, or I should say push your symptoms higher. So you start with, 3 out of 10 headache, you get on your phone 20 minutes and you've got a 5 out of 10 headache, probably start time to put your phone down and reset and let your symptoms settle back down. So similarly with, I'm sure you're familiar with, your ankle rehab, your calf rehab. You want to push to the point where you probably feel, your hammy a little bit, your calf and ankle a little bit, but you don't push it to the point where it's then increasing substantially through the rehab session. You're happy for it to hold, but not increase significantly. So I use that analogy quite a bit with screens and any stimulus that's irritating, whether that's noise, reading, whatever that might be.
Yeah, the noise one's interesting because the amount of kids you see take a head knock and they're sitting inside a loud basketball stadium straight away, that can't be good for it. Like the best way to get them out of there quickly.
Yeah, the whistles and the noise and someone bouncing the basketball behind you and the parents yelling behind you and yeah, and there's three courts in a row. It's a lot. So honestly, yeah, to be honest, it's probably even sitting on the bench would be a lot for someone. Just in terms of stimulus coming in, visual, auditory, yeah, everything about it's just a lot of stimulus. So yeah, look, realistically, if you've got a potential concussion, it's send them to a doctor, whichever way you can, like we said, ED, urgent care, GP. But yeah, it's probably not staying in the stadium, to be honest with you. Yeah, because it's a lot of noise straight away.
And I mean, this podcast is largely things that I've screwed up that I'm trying to tell people not to screw up in basketball. But I know I've done it with a player that had a concussion in the past. I'm like, oh, look, still come to practice and just sort of sit there and watch. And I look back at it now and it's like, idiot, what was I doing giving him bad advice when I probably should have just said, stay away until you've been checked out, cleared, come in when you're ready to come in, rather than me saying, hey, still be around the group in that space.
Yeah, correct. If they're ready, it's an interesting one. So, and again, this is where we come in a little bit, but we've also got to be careful not to hold them out too long, but we don't want to rush them back too quick. So it's a fine line. So even what I normally do is go, okay, we're going really well. We're getting rid of our symptoms. We're trending in the right direction. We've returned to school, work, whatever else as well. So we might be doing a couple of hours of school, a couple of hours of work, and we're trending in the right direction. Oh, I've got basketball training tonight. Can I go? Well, how about, if you've got a parent, let's go. And if after half an hour we start to get increasing symptoms, then it's time to head home. If you go and you last the whole hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever crazy basketball training times happen these days, then that's fine. That's great. But again, similar analogy to the hamstring, calf, ankle. Like if you're getting small increase, but it's manageable, that's okay. But if you're getting this big increase, well, no, you need to back it off and reset. But or if you stay the same and it doesn't make you any worse, that's fine. That's good.
Oh, I really, it's a strange one because we look at like strength and conditioning work in sport and those sorts of things, and people that do a lot of preventative work to make sure their knees, their ankles, their hips, their backs are all working in the best shape possible. Is concussion preventable, or are there any preventative measures that people can take, or is it just kind of luck of the draw in a lot of ways?
Yeah, good question. Good question. So in terms of protective gear, obviously not so much in basketball, but helmets in football. The research, unfortunately, says that they don't really reduce concussion risk. The reason being because the neck's still free. So concussion is acceleration, deceleration, and shearing force. So because the neck's free, can still get head knock, hip and shoulder, and get that whiplash type motion. Therefore, can still have a concussion. Helmets are still good for, your blunt force traumas, your skull fractures, your lacerations, that side of things. So not saying that helmets don't have a place, but for concussion, the research is a bit, more or less saying that they're not preventative. There's some research that I read a long time ago now that said potentially mouth guards could be protective. They thought at the time, if you knew the knock was coming, which again, how often does that happen? Probably rare, that you potentially grit your teeth, musculature basically tenses, and you reduce the trauma that goes through, or the sorry, the force that goes through the neck or the whiplash motion. Same with neck strength. It's great having a strong neck. Most boxers have really, really strong necks, but boxers also know they're probably going to get punched in the face. So you can brace a little bit. So if you get cleaned up in basketball, you're going back with the flight of the ball in football, whatever it is, and you don't know that knock's coming, doesn't matter how strong your neck is. Can it potentially help you in the rehab part of it? Maybe. We know having stronger hamstrings prior to a hamstring tear helps you with the recovery. So if you've got a whiplash, you've got stronger neck muscles prior to the whiplash, potentially that is a good thing for afterwards. But as far as I know, rule change is your best candidate for, trying to prevent concussions. The other thing is, Rob, and this isn't really answering your question at all, but we know concussions will continue to happen. That's part of sport and everyday life, whether it's someone falling off a cubby house, playground, car accidents, work accidents, sport, they will happen. But the important thing is that we treat them right when they do happen. So we follow up correctly. We don't miss delayed bleeds. We don't miss red flags. And then we actually put people through testing and return them to school, work, and sport correctly because, as I don't know how many hammies you've tweaked, if any, but if me or you go to a physio with a hammy tweak and we go in and they say, look, it's, 3 to 6 week hammy, you go, oh, well, that is what it is. But you say that for a concussion and people lose their minds still because they don't want to miss 3 to 6 weeks, but it's their brain this time and we're not talking about a hammy. So it's an interesting discussion. It's still a cultural might not be the right word, but it's sporting culture that it's exactly what you said at the start. Let's get back out there. Don't worry about it. You'll be right. That side of things. So I think just bringing it back, reining that in, and going, no, this is actually a traumatic brain injury. Let's treat it right so we don't get potential issues down the track. We don't prolong recovery, like we said. The other thing, and again, sorry, I'm on a bit of a tangent, but in terms of recovery, again, missed days at school, like year 12 student back end of the year last year, had a handful of year 12 students that are trying to do, VCE, and they've got a concussion and their brain's altered and their memory's altered, their cognition's altered. We want to treat that right because VCE, that's important. So, and same with work and income and lots of other things as well, driving independence, that side of things. So there's a lot that goes into it, Rob, but treating it correctly when it does happen, that's a big one.
Yeah, and I mean, for reference, never done a hamstring. Don't move anywhere near quick enough to have to deal with that, thankfully. But it is funny you say that because I think there's always been this sort of mentality around like head knocks are nothing, and as it's such a weird spot in basketball, I suppose, because you are so regularly at elbow height of so many people. If you're in a rebounding contest or if someone turns and pivots into you, your head's in that area, but you kind of get the double whammy as well, where you can get hit, you can be concussed and potentially knocked out on the first impact, and then you fall and hit the floorboards, which are not real forgiving as it turns out either. That impact to sort of have like two hits in one where you can't even protect yourself from the head knock you've got in the first place before you cop the second one, it can really do some damage to people.
In terms of the two knocks straight away, so let's say head knock slash concussion, and then fall and head hits floor because you're unconscious on the fall down, so no fall mechanism, no hands out. They, again, anecdotal evidence, it's not research written and that side of things, Rob, but they seem to be a lot worse in the clinic when they come in. We know that drop off in brain energy, again, going back to my graph that I visualize, if you drop down, so let's say we drop again, first 7 days, we drop down in brain energy. If we go, well, concussion Saturday, drop for the next 7 days, well, what are we doing in 7 days' time? We're playing again. So I haven't told anyone, I'm playing basketball again at day seven, okay? My brain energy is low. Let's go get another concussion, accidentally. And then reality is the research, I believe, has only been done in animal studies of that next drop. But I think it basically says that it could be somewhere between 90 to 120 day recovery. So 3 to 4 months. If you go and get that second knock at when your brain energy is low. Again, is the evidence rock solid and concrete on that? Potentially not. But it's enough to worry us about getting that second knock. So, going back to your question, head knock, second head knock, or concussion, second concussion in a matter of seconds. Yeah, it can't be good, put it that way. Yeah, I don't know exactly what the evidence says on that. I don't know how well it's been studied because it would be such a hard thing to study that one. But when I find out, I'll let you know, but it's a good one for me to look up after this as well. But in reality or in clinical terms, they seem to be more symptomatic than those that get a single knock.
So how do we go about changing the culture of this then? Because we've sort of touched on a little bit in that most people want to go with the, she'll be all right. Like, don't worry about it. And I certainly know I've had players that have got a head knock at a session I wasn't at when they're training with someone else. Then they come to me, they don't tell me anything. So I just assume they are as they normally are. And it's only when you start sort of saying, geez, you've been a bit vague the last couple of sessions that we've had you in. Has something happened prior to that? They say, oh, actually, yeah, I've got a head knock, but I didn't really want to tell anyone about that. How do we go about getting them to understand it? Is do we, I don't want to go full scare tactics or anything like that, but do they need to be aware of that and that will help it?
Potentially, I think the standards of whether it's the team, club, bigger environment, the standards of creating an environment where people feel comfortable to come to us or talk to us about it, that's a big one, especially for coaches. But I think information is a big one, and education is a huge one. I think if we deliver information sessions, whether it's to juniors, to seniors, to coaches, whoever that is, and we go, look, this is why we actually do need to take this seriously. It sort of sets in a lot more for people than go, you know what, I actually have a potential concussion. I actually probably should tell someone. That's great. So yeah, again, standards at the club. When I say standards, that it sounds like I'm having a dig at clubs for having no standards. That's not true. It's more just going, everyone's on the same page. So coaches, players, support staff, medicos, everyone's on the same page. If you get a potential concussion, you're coming off. And if you've got a symptom that wasn't there prior to that, you're likely going to sit the rest of the game out and be reviewed from a doctor. And if that's said at the start of the season, and again, this is just my experience in past teams and sporting environments, but if that's said at the start of the year, then it's no surprise to anyone when it does happen, and they also come forward. Again, that's not research-backed evidence, but it's the best we've got. The other thing is, Rob, which I'm not going to change, and I'm not sure how deep your pockets are with the podcast, but it might be a funding thing to get trained medical staff at games, at stadiums, whether that's just even a doctor at, I don't know what the rules are these days around like big tournaments, junior tournaments, like. I'm in Bendigo at the moment. We've got the big Junior Classic on Australia Day weekend that's just been and gone. I don't know whether they have to have a doctor on site or whether it's paramedics or how that works, but whether it's funding for that side of things as well, that's almost a government level conversation. But yeah, so there's a few things there, but I think if we take it back a step, sorry to ramble, everyone on the same page, that's probably a big thing. Yep, everyone on the same page before the season starts.
Yeah, I really like that. And it's certainly something we recommend to coaches is have that chat with parents about, look, here's how the season's going to function. Just add this in here. Like, I don't think it's going to hurt anyone by sort of saying, look, we care so much about the players that are in front of us that we're going to do the right thing by them for their long-term and short-term. We talk about long-term player development all the time, and it's not the kid that's in front of you now. It's what they could be in 10, 15 years and past that, when they're not basketballers anymore. This is such a valuable part of what that is. We talk about as coaches, yes, we want talented basketballers, but we want really good people. And this is no different in my mind as to what this could potentially look like. We are potentially you know, not necessarily saving lives, but certainly saving a quality of life, I think, for people by doing the right thing by them in a traumatic situation where they probably can't think for themselves in that right frame of mind.
And that's the other thing. We put a lot of onus on the player to come forward, but reality is they're in an altered state of consciousness, might not be the right term, but they are altered. Their cognition is altered. So they might not be actually be able to have the higher order thinking to go, I actually need to get off this ground or court. It actually might be on the staff to go, look, like potential concussion, potential or head knock slash whiplash injury, potential concussion, let's go and get them off. Okay. And then we also need like referees on board as well, or umpires to go, you know what, I actually saw this. No one else might have seen it, but I saw this. You actually need to go off and get checked. So stop the game, go off and get checked. You know, it's a game of under 16s. No one's, you know, winning land over it. So let's go and do that. So you're right. Yeah, it's a big one. But I also, you know, and this dives probably more into your territory, Rob, but so many skills for young people are learned through sports. So team sports in particular, I believe. So standards, looking after yourself, being part of a team, following instructions. So, you know, being injured and knowing that, you know, you can't be back out there at the moment. You've got to go through the process of being injured and doing the right recovery, and then you can come back. It's part of sort of learning in a way as well, and a part of life that you're not always, you know, going to be able to do what you want to do. So you might have to go through a couple of crap times to work back into it. So that's part of it as well. So if they can learn that lesson, I don't want them to be injured to have to learn that lesson. But, you know, there's a lesson in there somewhere as well, I'm sure, philosophical lesson, but yeah.
No doubt. I really like that, to be honest, because I think it is. It's. I mean, we talk about it with mental health all the time. I think in that, you know, if you're not feeling right, put your hand up. It's no different. Like this is, you know, just a head knock that, you know, we can circumvent some of the longer term problems if we do it the right way. I'm just curious, is there any advice for people in the concussion space we haven't spoken about today? Are there any sort of additional reading they can do if they're curious on this, or apps they can download, or anything in that sort of space that can help them?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would go to the AIS website. They've got some good stuff on concussion. They've got a brain concussion and brain injury position statement published in 2024, so the most recent guidelines. Go and have a read of that. If you're a trainer, if you're a coach, go on to the staff. There's a staff tab or a coaches tab, and just be up to date with some stuff. Have a read through. You're not supposed to be a doctor or know everything about it, but just knowing, especially the red flags, is a big one. That's what I read. Rate to a lot of people. If you know the red flags and go, okay, they've had a potential concussion. Do they have any of these? Okay, they do have one of them. Okay, hospital. That's mandatory. That has to happen. So even if you just know them and you go, okay, potential concussion, we've looked through it all. No, they don't have any of these red flags. Well, that's great. Okay, they've got a potential concussion. They still need to see a doctor. So that's a big one. So I would visit the AIS website, would be my tip for a lot of people. Have a read through a lot of stuff. It's all up-to-date information. The AIS, I think, do a really, really good job of what they put out there. So that's a big one.
Yeah, awesome. And how can people get in touch with you if they do unfortunately need to come and see you? I say that with no disrespect intended, because cracking guy and all that sort of stuff, very generous with your time. But you know, if they do need to be in a position where they come and see you, how do they do that?
So the best way is to go and see a doctor and then either ask for a referral. If you've had a concussion for longer than 4 weeks and you're still having symptoms, you can come straight in without that referral. So in terms of getting hold of us, www.bendigoconcussion.com.au, and then the same for Ballarat, except www.ballaratconcussion.com.au. So visit the website. You can book in online, do all that side of things, all the information about the clinics online. Phone number is on there as well, and then email address, all that side of things on there as well. So yeah, if you need us, yeah, phone call away or an email. But yeah, there's also an inquiry section on the website. But yeah, if people have more questions or have clubs, we do presentations to clubs and schools and everything in between as well. So we're pretty big on them this time of year. We'll probably start to tail them off a little bit soon with being full in the clinic with different just yeah, clients and patients. But yeah, we do that side of things as well. The other thing that we do, Rob, is we come to clubs and do baseline testing as well. So we've been a big one this year, particularly the last couple of months, going to clubs, doing a bit of baseline testing. So we've got information. So if the player does get a concussion, we've got information that we can compare to, especially with their cognitive tests. The other thing that it does, Rob, is that the baseline testing drives them to go and see someone, which is a big, big thing. So if yourself done a baseline test, go get a concussion. Oh, I've got my baseline test. Let's go and see someone so I know that I'm right to go back. Even if the baseline test was only to drive people to go and see someone, it's worth doing that way. So a lot of particularly football, netball clubs, and then basketball clubs are coming up as well. It's starting to get on board with a lot of that stuff. And like I said, even if it's just driving people to go and get checked, that's a big one as well.
Really like it. Daniel, thank you very much for your time. It's been a great source of information on this one. It is an incredibly important area of the sport that we've probably neglected for a little while now, that I think is coming more and more front of mind. Pardon the concussion pun on that one. But I think it is something that we're going to see more and more of as we become more and more aware of it. So, coaches, please get yourself across it. Players that are listening, don't lie for a start. If there's a problem, flag it out. And parents, please be across this as well, because obviously they are your kids in this space, and we want to make sure that we protect those kids and adults for that matter, playing as much as we possibly can. So, Daniel, thanks very much for your time jumping in today. Really appreciate it.
No worries at all, Rob. Thanks very much for having me. And yep, thank you very much.
Huge thanks to Daniel Hamilton from the Ballarat and Bendigo Concussion Clinics for jumping into the podcast today. Great resources, I think, for a lot of people out there that might have just that little bit of naivety as to what this actually looks like in its real form, I think, as coaches and as players and as parents, and some of the warning signs that we need to look out for as well. I'll put the links to the AIS resources in the show notes. So if you're looking for those, you'll be able to find them in the show description. Again, if you can follow along, and if you want more information, follow along to the Bendigo and Ballarat Concussion Clinics at Bendigo Concussion Clinic and at Ballarat Concussion Clinic on Instagram. You'll be able to see some of the resources and some of the things that Daniel's doing in that space. And a massive thanks to him for jumping in with a busy schedule, obviously, but also just giving up his time to help educate as many people as we possibly can. Coaches, thanks very much. We'll catch you again next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Talking Split Podcast. Make sure you like and comment on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to share and subscribe so that you never miss an episode.